So we had to. I can't answer that. I'm podcasting. It's Jamie.
Welcome to Still Untitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I am Norm.
I didn't sleep very well last night, guys.
No, now how come? Because of a baby?
I was going to guess.
No. The baby sleeps better than anybody I know. We put her to bed at 8 o'clock, and then she wakes up at like 9 o'clock the next morning, and she's a lazy baby.
So what the hell's your problem?
So last night was cooking night. So we, these days, because a lot of times Gene will be out all day and then get in late,
yeah.
We'll batch cook, say, 4 days worth of meals on one night.
Okay.
And then we end up with a complete, you know, then we basically have TV dinners that are actually made of real food and are delicious.
Right.
So last night was the night that we were cooking. And I was supposed to get a pork tenderloin. I got a pork butt instead. So what was a quick sear and like low roast to get the pork tenderloin cooked became a 4-hour braise to get the connective tissue broken down and stuff like that.
So
it was
tasty. Pissed about that?
No, I was pissed because I was the one who was up until 12:30 with it. But yeah, so then...
So you brought it on yourself.
It was a mistake of my own making. But that doesn't make me any less tired this morning.
12:30, that's time for second dinner.
Second breakfast.
Second dinner is for young men. If somebody my age eats second dinner, I'll blossom up to be twice the man I am today.
What?
However,
so when my boys were really young, their mom and I, that's the fine way to say that, their mom and I had an arrangement in which, because the twins are just a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. So you told me.
Yeah.
When I said, hey, my wife's pregnant, you said, oh, it's one or two. I said, we don't know yet. And you said, hope for twins. It's just as easy as one.
I agree with it. Well, here's the thing.
I think it was a lie.
No, I what kills you with babies is the focus. It's the, you can't ever relax your focus and you must be engaged with them constantly. And that's not just because they're trying to kill themselves all the time, but it's also because, which they are, right? Yeah. Why can't Mr. Penn and Mr. Socket be friends? But it's also because that's how they develop, right? That's how they build their self.
Constantly,
right?
Challenging the world. Yeah.
And also with your love and your empathy with them, right? But so I would work at ILM. I got hired at ILM just around the time the boys were born. And so I'd work from probably, I'd leave the house at, I guess, 7:45, be back home by 6:15. And then I would take the boys from then until the morning.
So then I would do
all the night feedings, night changings and stuff like that. And there were a lot of nights when they were between, I think, 3 months and probably 14 months old, when I would just take them out for a drive and drive around San Francisco for like 3 or 4 hours, which is like a classic dad suburbia thing.
It's a Mad About You episode.
It is totally.
Literally.
I would just call my friend David in New York on the headphones and just, we'd shoot the breeze. Late at night,
while
the kids slept in the back. Also, they were very good sleepers in restaurants. So I would go out with my friend Michael Gray like once a week for dinner and just take them and perch them with bottles on either side.
So that's one of the best pieces of advice I got from you and multiple other people. It was like, anything you want to do for the next 5 years, make sure you do in the first 6 months.
Throw dinner parties, make lots of noise,
exactly.
Take them out to dinner,
listen to loud movies, do all the stuff that you want to be able to keep doing, run the dishwasher.
Yep.
And we did that. So we took her out to lots of restaurants and stuff like that. And now she is a super chill. Like, she totally digs restaurants.
Oh yeah.
Like, she goes, she knows the drill. She sits down, she gets some puffs. We put out her little placemat. The food comes. She knows how to eat it. She like looks around at people and it makes that part of our lives civilized still, which
it's
is
like,
important.
It's like when you see the house where it's like, don't ring the doorbell, there's a baby in here. I think, oh, you're doing it. Like, I recognize everybody's situation is different, and I don't want to say I'm judging you. I'm just saying.
No, you're judging them.
No, I'm just saying if you want, you need to prepare for what you're willing to put up with.
Yes, yes.
Because things could get nasty.
And if you have to snip the wires on the doorbell, probably, I mean, just as a testament to how, and we'll move on to the real topic in 2 seconds. We have a dog who barks. We live in a small house on a small lot, and she's protective of an area that is larger than the area that we own.
Yes.
And it encompasses the sidewalk. So whenever a kid skateboards down the sidewalk and she hears it, she flips out and starts barking. She did that the entire time my wife was pregnant. And when she was born and came home, she doesn't flinch as a result of the dog barking. Like, it doesn't affect her. She doesn't wake up.
Oh, nice. Yes,
the
yes,
dog
yes.
can be literally sitting outside of her bedroom window, barking her little furry ass off.
Yep.
And the baby doesn't move because she's accustomed to it.
You know, I'll tell you that actually the twins, thing one and thing two, never woke each other up. Of one course. Would be yeah. howling and the other snoring right next yeah. to them. It was amazing. Do you listen to this with just eye rolling, Norm, or are you planning to squeeze out a punk or two later on in your life?
Maybe later on.
Okay.
You have time.
I'm absorbing.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't wait too long. It's much easier when you're younger.
What's really funny is, and I might have said this on the cast before, but what's very funny is the moment you see your kid, the very moment you first see your kid.
Bloody, covered with gore.
You have this, it's exactly like Trinity learning how to fly a helicopter. You go, ooh, oh, I understand 80% of my parents.
Yeah.
Instantly.
I've said it before. When my daughter was 4 days old, I wrote a letter to my mom and I wrote a letter to my dad. And I was like, I am so sorry for all of the shit that I did. This was after doing the 12-mile-an-hour drive home from the hospital.
Right.
You know, where we're like, we need to stay on surface roads. We need to keep single lane.
Could you believe it that they actually gave you the baby to take home? No. You're like, what? 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 They're like, yeah, it's time. See you. Don't let the door yeah. hit you in the ass on the way out.
At some point, the guy who pushes the wheelchair with my wife in it out is just like, well, okay, good luck, guys.
We were on the sidewalk. We were like, this is crazy. Well, they were 3 and 4 pounds.
Oh, God.
When
could
we got
put them
home.
In a car seat?
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, they were freaking tiny.
Like, that's like.
Oh, yeah. Bomb. You could hold them both with them. On one arm. They were.
Oh, my goodness.
About this big swaddle.
Do you ever look at them?
They were, cool.
I've
the
eaten
eggs.
Burritos nearly as big as thing one.
Do you ever look at them now and think, you know.
All the
you
time.
You little bastards. No.
I think about that all the time. I mean, I have growing up in the digital age, I got my first Canon Rebel. When did that first come out?
2003 or 2002, okay. Somewhere in there.
So I had the Canon SureShot in 99 when
digital.
It first came out. Yeah.
Okay.
And I took crap tons of photos of that. And then I got the Rebel. So I've got probably 10,000 photos of the boys over the years. Maybe not 10,000.
I bet
like
you have 10,000.
But it's I've got them at every age. And it's really a pleasure to go back through because so much of who they are now is fully extant in those
you can see
tiny
it.
Babies. You yeah. can see it. You can see their, you know, the outgoingness, the inwardness, the personality traits you like and don't like. It's
the
all
smiles
there.
The same.
Yeah, it's really it's lovely. It's a lovely record to have. Wow, we're already 10 minutes in?
Or no? Something like that. Sorry about that.
Oh, that was... No, that's actually just what time it is.
Oh, yeah. speaking of...
What time it is?
Children and what time it
oh,
is.
Oh, okay.
We wanted to do Q&A today.
Yes!
And we might do 2 episodes of Q&A. We got a bunch of good questions.
Awesome.
Okay.
But let's see how far we get down the list. I'm going to start... The first question is actually... There's 2 questions and they kind of feed into each other. So I'm going to read them both and then we can address them and I'll make sure we circle back.
Okay.
And as always, if you have a question, the email address is podcast@tested.com. Put it the subject line questions for Adam just so we can separate these from the other questions we get. And that'll make it a lot easier for us.
It really will. And making it easier for us is your job.
Yes. Well, when hundreds and hundreds of emails a day, Adam.
I'm just giving you shit. Go ahead.
Uncooked Meatloaf says.
I love usernames.
How do you figure out how to make something? I have all these ideas for things to create, but can never seem to find the right way to move something or put something together in a way that it forms what I want. Going from a flat plan to a 3D object is hard.
Yes.
So the next question is, I would love it if you guys could list off a few specific props or projects that might be considered a good introduction into prop building. I'm just getting started, and the projects that I began researching all ended up being a little more complex than I originally intended. I eventually settled on a Pepakura Bondo Dread helmet, which was pretty easy, cheap, and unique in the imperfections to just make it look like it was weathered. What other foolproof iconic props do you think could help a novice maker pick up some skills and maybe build a little self-confidence in the process? And that's from Christopher Schmidt.
Awesome. Those are a great pair
I thought it was
of questions.
A good one, too, right?
I love that. Okay. First things first, my son thing one was in here. He cut himself to ribbons with a Leatherman that he got for Christmas. And we went to the emergency room and he didn't need stitches at the end and it healed quite well. And I gave him his Leatherman back after about a month and a half, which he didn't expect, which is kind of why I did it. Because you need to get back on that horse.
He's at an age now that he's going to cut himself and he'll get better. And then he can cut himself again.
Exactly. What's that? He can whittle. Yeah, he was whittling, but his finger was ahead of the blade. He was whittling a carrot. at 1 a.m.
That's what these kids do these days.
Yes.
Okay.
So
I can see that. I can see where you get there.
So we wanted to make a holder for his Leatherman, and we broke out some leather, and he said, you know, what should I do? And I said, you need to make a pattern. You need to think through what it's going to be. And I already had an idea about the structure, a simple structure. But I said, right off the bat, you need to resolve yourself. You're going to build this 3 or 4 times. Just right now, give in, give up, and know that you're going to go 80% down and realize you have to start from scratch. And that's going to happen at least twice.
Inevitably, as soon as I make the first cut, I'm like, wow, the better way to do this would have been something that is now impossible because I've already cut the first piece of wood.
And this throws a lot of people off. They think that a craftsman picks up materials and just starts assembling them. Mm-hmm. If I do seem to do that sometimes in my projects, it's because I've been doing a tremendous amount of building in my head, which is the luxury of experience. But you are always going to build stuff several times. And recognizing that, and then perhaps starting with simpler materials like foam core, foam board, which you can buy with soft or rigid sides at the art store for relatively few bucks per sheet, is a great prototyping material.
So it's more forgiving.
Cardboard.
Yeah.
And it's cheap and easy to place.
It hot glues together beautifully, crazy glues together beautifully. Don't use Elmer's glue on it. It would be useless. And you can sample sizes and proportions with it before you start cutting expensive materials. So I'm a big fan of prototyping. At Industrial Light and Magic, we prototyped everything before we built it. It allowed us to understand everything from the volumes that we'd be dealing with to whether or not we'd need new machinery to cut certain parts of it to understanding how to build the framework inside of it.
Well, and if you're doing something that requires repetition, like if you need to make 10 pieces of something, then figuring out what the best way to put that together is can actually save a lot of time and energy. Later on.
Exactly.
The thing I would say is that transition from 2D to 3D that Uncooked Meatloaf asked about,
yeah,
is just something that comes with practice and doing it a lot, I think.
Well,
right?
Yes. And again, people are so often hamstrung by the, I want to build this in the right way. And they think
the first time.
They think that means the first time. And I remember learning to cut with a single edge razor blade. My dad used to make fun of me. It's like, stop trying to cut through all of the mat board on the first cut. You're wasting your time. Nobody does that. It takes 3 cuts to cut through a full piece of cardboard like that. You just got to go gently and let the cut guide the blade. And cardboard, really, the best way to get good at building is just to start. So don't hamstring yourself thinking, I don't have the wood, I don't have the springs, I don't have the machinery. Just grab some cardboard and start prototyping. Those prototypes, frankly... Well, a foghorn going by the building.
It's a nice motorcycle.
Frankly, those prototypes that I have of builds that I completed later are treasured possessions of mine. I love looking at that first iterative try at something.
So keep at it with cardboard until you get something that you're happy with.
And cardboard then box. Cardboard, yeah. Really, So my son ended up prototyping the Leatherman holder 4 times out of corrugated cardboard. He kept calling back and he'd go, oh, but this one needs to go there. And I'm like, okay, you can tape it on both sides with Gorilla tape or masking tape here and you can do this. Oh, but you need this piece to be bigger. So he learned very quickly, it's better to cut large and then trim down than to start trying to add on. And again, then he cut it out of leather, learned that the leather was little, but he had a pattern. Mm-hmm. And again, I was right. It took him 4 tries to get the pattern right, but he only cut out the leather once. Mm. Now, as far as a cool project that you can build that's satisfying, one of the communities of prop builders out there who have been fantastic, and I think we've gone over this on podcasts in the past, but who've been fantastic about documenting and reference is the Ghostbusters prop builders.
Yeah.
They are... Everything you want to know about Ghostbusters props is out there, and not only out there, but put into beautifully illustrated infographics with layout plans that you can print out on A4 or 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper. And I would recommend a ghost trap.
Mm. It's simple. There's a lot of straight edges, so it's not going to be hard on curves and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, there are also, not only have the Ghostbusters fans gone and figured out all the little valves and stuff that went on the backpack and the plasma wand and the ghost trap, but they've also worked out cheap hardware store solutions for all of those bits and bobs. Oh, you don't need this. You just need a number 10 sink trap. Go and get that. And that looks 80, 90%
as good. And it's that industrial look, so the hardware store is going to be...
Exactly.
Most of
well, and it's also something that gets used, so you can ding it up a little bit, weather it up nicely. It'll look good.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's a really good call.
It's really, I built a ghost trap. And it was an incredibly pleasurable one day project. It was very simple and very fun. And it, like I said, if you go search Ghostbusters forums, Ghostbuster props, Ghostbuster ghost trap plans or blueprints, you're going to find tons of stuff. Just make a folder, throw it in there, and your only question will be, do you want to put lights inside?
Right. Yeah.
And there are actually people that sell full lighting kits for like $30 or $40.
Well, but now you can get a strip of blue LEDs from Amazon for $15. So.
It's true, but even still, a lot of people are going to prefer that entry level. You know, put a 9-volt battery and it's got the little chaser in it, and your ghost trap looks totally like it's factory made.
We did a video with Frank from Capolito, and if people want to get into the effects and want to learn materials, because that's something that Frank talks about all the time.
Yes.
Learning so many different types of rubbers, silicones, casting materials, molding materials. A simple mold of your hand, alginate mold of your hand, not expensive at all.
No.
You get something immediate. You get to work with alginate, you get to work with silicone.
And then you get to paint it.
And you get to paint it.
Yeah.
And you learn mixing, you learn pouring, you learn waiting for time. And you get something really cool.
Absolutely. I did a project. I actually wrote this up in Wired for their Geek Dad issue. A project where my sons and I, we took Super Sculpey and we made negative molds that we poured plaster into.
Oh, cool.
So they got to experience thinking backwards, which is really cool from a mental standpoint. Mm-hmm. And I actually made something which I still have in my office at home, which is I made a dodo fossil. So I sort of sculpted a skeletal flattened fossil of a dodo, and because I'd sculpted it into the Super Sculpey, when I poured plaster on top of the Super Sculpey, I ended up with a relief of a dodo skeleton. It looks awesome.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Now our next question.
Yes.
Which my phone.
That was great pair of questions.
Well, hopefully we can follow up with something else good. Icy Klingons wants to know, do you think the new Star Wars movie's use of models will result in more model making in films?
Oh, that is a really good question. It depends if it makes a shit ton of money or not.
It's a Star Wars movie, right? The bar from it making a shit ton of money starts really, really high.
Yeah. You know, I think that I feel like the powers that be that are pushing the Star Wars universe forward are making all of the right
moves. Kathleen Kennedy and people on her team?
And Disney whoever's making all of those decisions to hire JJ, to hire Ryan Johnson.
Gareth Edwards.
All of those guys.
Gary, I guess.
Really,
I
really, really great decisions. Abrams' decision to go to more practical effects. You know,
and not as a token gesture.
No, not as a token gesture. There are big directors who love using practical effects. Guillermo del Toro, Peter Jackson, Jon Favreau. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the biggest problem is that model work is expensive. And frankly, it's a lot more expensive than CG. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But primarily, it's the fact that to have 10 people in a model shop requires at least, if you have a model shop with 10 people, you need at least like 4,000 or 5,000 square feet to accommodate them. You need 400 or 500 square feet to accommodate 5 CG artists.
Right.
It's those economies of scale are diabolical, and they existed at ILM. They exist for anybody. But as long as JJ may actually bring in a movement of doing practical models. Look, we're at a stage where there are camera stabilization platforms that I think are going to usurp the Steadicam within the next 3 years.
The gimbals based stuff,
yeah,
things like that.
A Steadicam, if you don't know, is a camera stabilization platform that the operator wears on their body. It was invented by Garrett Brown in the 70s, used in films like Rocky, American Werewolf in London, and The Shining. And then in every movie you've ever seen since, Steadicam shots they allowed filmmakers to be freed from the dolly shot and do all sorts of unbelievable things with cameras.
It's the shot of him following the little boy on the big wheel is the one that I always think of as the first like That's the first one I think of as this is a Steadicam.
Following the boy in the big wheel in The Shining. And the fact is that shot was done before the Steadicam was a product. Garrett Brown was using his first prototype to shoot that.
He shot that. Oh, I didn't know that.
He also shot all of the speeder races through the Marin Redwoods for Return of the Jedi. That's all Garrett Brown too.
Wow.
Steadicam. It is a very difficult piece of equipment to operate. All you need to do is put one on for a second, as I did, to immediately understand that Steadicam operators are physical geniuses.
Ron Erickson found that out the hard way.
It is really, yes.
Yeah.
It is really hard to operate one of those things. And now we've got motors that can potentially keep a camera stable under the most completely adverse conditions for $5,000,
yeah,
$6,000,
and they're only going to get cheaper.
Yeah, for the record, a used Steadicam starts at about $25,000 to $30,000, and new ones can be into the six figures.
The good news is, once the gimbal stuff takes over, then the Steadicams, the price will go down dramatically.
It is possible that people could start building motion control camera platforms and shooting models in their house. I mean, just again, for the uninitiated, special effects done in the old Star Wars way, they would mount the model on a stand, and they'd move the camera past it. And because it was all against black, when you look at the footage, it looks like the model's flying past the camera.
So the camera moves the opposite path and yada yada.
Right.
Computer controlled.
Yeah. But the robots that you use to do that now are available.
You could potentially, you can build a 3D printer, you could build a motion control platform.
Yes.
So nobody's doing that yet that I know of, but somebody could do a Kickstarter project with laser cut.
See y'all later.
Laser cut wood on skateboard wheels, and all of a sudden you could do, frankly, 95% of the image quality that John Dykstra was getting with his first motion control platform in 1976, now with, you know, a few $100 worth of hardware.
Well, and the other thing that I think is also
happening. Wow, that is such a good idea. I totally want someone to run it.
I'm going to cut this question out. but the other thing that will happen is, I think we'll see more, the best films that use practical, the CGI and practical effects are merging them to the point that it's really hard to tell what's practical and what's CG. Like the shot in, you mentioned it before, the shot in Pacific Rim where the robot or the kaiju punches through the building and it hits the little Newton's cradle and it starts tapping at the end is a good example of that.
Absolutely. Yeah, so. Absolutely.
Do it where it makes sense. You know, blowing up a building sometimes. Cheaper to build the miniature and
pyro and water are always easier to do practically than to do in CG. But again, that is
that changes.
That is constantly changing. I hope. The answer is I hope. I really do hope. And you know, Abrams is, all you have to do is watch Super 8 to know that Abrams is bottle raised on Spielberg and Lucas's film aesthetic and really understands them in a way that's totally deep and wonderful. I have the best hopes for the new Star Wars.
Who are the other filmmakers? I mean, Guillermo for sure, but
Peter Jackson, although, you know, there's a lot of CG in Hobbit. When I met Peter in New Zealand a few weeks ago, he was very clear that he loves the practical effects.
Well, you mean he built a whole studio to make orc swords.
Absolutely.
Right?
And Favreau, you know, he came by the set and I mentioned, I love that he loves practical effects, and he just lit up to talk about how much fun it is in Zathura and Iron Man to do things practically and to give the audience a sort of a much more physical sense of what's going on. That's and the actors, you know, frankly, it's like, I don't think we're ever going to get to a place, I'll say this, where all films are just actors in green suits against a green background with everything composited on them. Nobody wants to make those movies. Movies should be fun to make for the people making them, as well as being fun to watch. And it's fun to put on costumes and play that these giant things are happening. And that's one of the reasons actors do it so much, you know?
That was a very thorough answer.
Okay, next question.
Dean Wilhite says, it took Adam years to build his Hellboy Mecha Glove. How long did the original builder have to build it? And did you ever get to talk to the folks who built the original design?
I did. I talked extensively with the builders, with many of them. I think the team that built the original Mecha Glove was probably six or seven people. It could have been larger. It was made by Spectral Motion, which is run by Mike Elizalde, who's a good friend of mine. And they did a ton of Hellboy props and a ton of Pacific Rim props. They are an amazing full service shop. So they do everything from aesthetic and leatherwork, sewing, soft goods to hard animatronic. They did the wings of death from Hellboy 2 with the eyes in it. Yep. They did Samael in Hellboy is almost entirely practical and not CG. All those tentacles and the blinking eyes, all of that's practical. I don't know. I never asked Mike how long that job actually took, but my guess would be at least 3 months.
Okay.
That is about that kind of job in my head as an estimator.
Is that the kind of thing when people say movies are in pre-production, they're building stuff like that, they're finishing script, they're doing storyboards and...
Absolutely. Okay. And so the pre-production would be, you know, Guillermo has drawings done by, in this case, Mike Mignola did the first drawings of the Mecha Glove, and then Ty Ruben Ellingson, who's an art director, a friend of mine, and Tori Beleches, who we used to work with at ILM, did the final drawing of. And then Mike and his team get that drawing and start fleshing it out. So they first make a mock-up of the original, of the size. Guillermo comes by and checks it out. Then they start talking about the pieces and parts and bits and bobs, the lighting, the weathering, etc. And this goes over a period of time as the director keeps coming by and saying, I like this. Okay, make this more like this and take this down a notch and make this silver instead of gold.
So at that point, do they know how it's going to be used on screen?
Well, so Mike Elizalde told me that the one thing they had been told was it's not going to be raining when we're filming with this glove. And they arrive in... I don't think they shot in Scotland. I think they shot in Budapest or over there in Eastern Europe somewhere. Of course, pouring rain for the entire
soaking,
sequence.
Soaking, yeah.
So you can look at close-up pictures of the glove and you can see silicone around the motor contacts that they scrambled to waterproof this thing.
Wow.
With electrics in it. It's a testament to his team that they were absolutely able to film with this glove in pouring rain when they hadn't planned for it. Right. The main mechanical guy on the glove is a friend of mine named Mark Satrakian. And Satrakian is, he's like one of those alien level intelligences when it comes to making animatronic things. He designed the tentacles for Samael, where three tentacles were operated, moving seemingly independently off of a single motor.
Really?
Yeah.
It was neat.
Brilliant, brilliant piece of engineering. And he's built everything. I first met him as part of Robot Wars in the early 90s. Everyone was building robots, you know, flying wedges. Mm-hmm. And Jamie and I built Blendo, which was the first centrifugal robot. Satrakian showed up with a goddamn snake. I mean, like a 12-foot long snake that could wrap around, and it had a drill in the middle of its three clawed mouth and would, like, totally impractical but beautiful with sliding sections. And then the next year, independent six-legged spider whose three sections could rotate 360 degrees independently of each other.
Oh, wow.
So it could actually just roll itself sideways or walk forward. I mean, everything that he builds has this kind of... moment about it. And like I said, he's a good friend and a bloody genius. So it's lovely to show him. He came to the party. He was at the party at Comic-Con.
Oh, cool.
And it was lovely to show him the piece. And he was like, you crazy bastard. Like, he's one of the few people who really understood what went into the Mecha Glove.
Our next question is from Ed Bisdy. He says, you guys have talked a lot about how to make the most of being a new job, being new to a job or being an intern. But when you've got an apprentice or intern working for you, how can you make the best use of their time to both balance their learning needs and still get the job done well that you need done under tight, stressful deadlines? I assume you guys don't really have an internship program on MythBusters for
fairly obvious
reasons.
We don't anymore. Well, yeah, the California law, the interns can't actually do substantive work.
Yeah.
So it really, California law has, I believe, I could be wrong about this, but it has codified employer, it has made employers to understand that an internship is not free labor. You actually have to be teaching them something and actively teaching them something that's not taking work away from someone you could pay to do your work, which I agree with in principle.
However, it made everywhere when that happened, we just killed our internship program. Well,
the problem is that because some people were actually getting shit tons of free labor out of their interns, and that's not good. Right. I don't think that's right.
No, absolutely. I mean, but at the same time, at the time we were at a magazine, and I mean, Norm was an intern before he started working at the magazine.
Yeah. And that's a great way to actually, it's a great, internship is a great way to build a farm team.
In some industries, definitely. Like if you're a programmer and your intern has programming skills and could actually be making real, should just be paid.
Yeah.
That's different than somebody who, say, is a fledgling career desire to be a journalist or to be in film production or something like that and needs to come in and kind of learn how to do stuff.
Yeah.
Because that's not stuff that you learn. You have to learn that on the job.
And also the employer has to see your approach to your work ethic. I mean, frankly, I feel like so let's say I built an internship program here. I don't have one, and I'm not planning on doing it.
Don't send resumes.
But if I had an internship program here, I would mostly look towards the projects I was giving the intern to provide them with information and knowledge about how this business works. Beyond that, frankly, I consider that they're on their own.
You want to give them freedom.
I want to give them freedom, and I want to see what their response is. I'm not going to take too much care of them because that's not how the world works. Your boss isn't going to hold your hand through the whole thing. I'm going to want someone to ask questions. I'm going to want someone who's curious and interested in how things work. But I'm also going to want someone who can absolutely take a ball and run with it, and who understands the answer to their question, or if they don't feel like it's fully answered, asks again, you know?
So
what do you think? I mean, you probably actually supervise more interns than I have.
I've been an intern, and then I supervised tons of interns over the 10 years I was in magazine publishing. And the thing, including some mutual friends, the thing that we did was we had a set of assigned tasks. Here are the things that you have to do. Like these are, you're required to do these as part of the job.
Right.
But they were designed to not take the entire day. And this was modeled off of the internship that I had as a 19-year-old on Capitol Hill working for a congressman.
Nice.
And there I basically had a set of tasks that ate up, let's say, 3 or 4 hours of an 8-hour day.
Right.
And then I had basically a pool of other things I could do with the rest of that time. I could give, if there were constituents in the office, I could give tours.
Mm-hmm.
I could go sit in committee meetings and take notes for the congressman, mm-hmm. which was always kind of fascinating because you got to see actual government happening in the backroom committee meetings. And so we would do the same thing. So at the magazine, you know, you have to do the letters, you have to collect answers for this column or that column or whatever. You have to help, you know, carry stuff up and down to photography.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the time, you can do what you want. Here's a stack of products that we have here that we don't have anybody assigned to review.
Right.
You can pick one of those and talk to us about how to review it. You can go out and, you know, work on something for the website.
Yeah.
You know,
that's great.
I think giving them and then the thing that happened was the people that had initiative kind of rose to the top, and the people that didn't, we just didn't renew.
Yeah. And that's where, you know, I think it's arguable whether or not we have an actual meritocracy in this country, but that is functionally based on the idea of a real meritocracy. You want to see the people who are hungry and who have a taste for the business that they're interning in and have a fire to move forward in it. And frankly, those folks don't require a lot of handholding. You can smell them from a mile off.
I mean, the thing that the difference in the questions were, you could tell from the questions that they asked. The people who needed handholding would say, hey, what should I do now? And the people who like wanted to go out and learn how to do new things would say, hey, how do I do this? And that made a huge difference. And those were the people that we hired and got real jobs. And it was much easier from a management perspective to do that than to say, here's 50 things you need to do today.
Yeah.
So it worked for everyone.
Yeah. It's hard. Delegation is its own work, right? Making the list and figuring out how they're going to get it done.
Okay. So our next question, sorry, I had to pay my parking meter, so Evernote closed. Hi. Hey, guys. I was watching one of your videos with Adam about model making. In it, you mentioned that there are unspoken rules in the model making world. Would you like to talk about any of those rules on the podcast? Can you?
Unspoken rules.
Jacob Salata. I think we were talking about casting probably and stuff like that. Maybe.
It's going back to recasting.
I think it was when we were talking about recasting and things that maybe you've made and you cast a version of for yourself before it goes out or whatever. Yeah.
You know, so. Well, we're just guessing here because this is in the context of a larger conversation that I can't quite
recall. Some of these questions were a while ago. So
yeah.
I mean, we can cut it if you don't think it's...
No. Okay. I think that's totally reasonable to talk about. I mean, you know, we're still talking about a dying industry, but if you're working in model shop, in a model shop, and you're working with props and stuff for big movies.
Any effects house, really, right?
Any effects house. The fact is that if you are going to want pictures of your work, you should get them, but no one should ever see you doing that, and those should never show up in the world.
Right. Don't post them on your
right.
Instagram.
I mean, you know, I was frankly lucky and smart at the beginning. I have pictures of all of my prop making going back to 1993. I even took film. I have film. I have slides of original stuff that I built for Jamie in the early 90s.
Don't let him know that.
But, you know, I was discreet with that stuff.
Yeah.
I was decidedly discreet with it.
But I mean, it's within your rights to make a portfolio, right?
No, your employment contract really usually explicitly states at ILM, they were very clear, you know, you could be fired for taking pictures within the model shop.
So then how do you, when you leave ILM and go someplace else, how do you say, hey, this is what my, cause like,
I have it in a portfolio and I show a physical document. I don't email those documents out.
But I'm saying if you didn't take the photos, how would you?
You could probably find screenshots or screen grabs, and stuff like that to show but
that's not like unedited work.
No, not at all. I mean, actually during episode 2, some pictures came out of the model shop and it's like, we could see what was going on in the model shop based on the picture that leaked out and know that it was someone we'd been working with. Huh. And it really upset us.
Oh,
like, wow, that's someone within this community who took a picture of this room. I remember that day I was working on this part of that model from Topoka City and some asshole took a picture and put it out there. And I don't think it was one of the ILM modelers either. I think it might have been some, you know, somebody from another department coming through.
Right.
But still, it felt a little like a violation.
Yeah.
I mean, so that falls in the category of like what you're.
You don't burn the locals.
Is there such
right?
a limitation?
You don't burn
for
the
that?
Locals. But and frankly, I will tell you that like I have a sort of a spongy. I think that there's a big gray area. I understand my employment contract at ILM stipulated I wasn't to take pictures of what I was working on. And part of me says, the heck with that. I'm going to take pictures for posterity so my kids can see stuff that I built.
Yeah.
And if I'm not going to post them anywhere, then everyone should be fine.
None
with
the wiser.
Yeah. I'm not hurting anyone because I trust myself. Now, that is a terrible attitude to go and promote out in the world because it could be misused in all sorts of different ways.
Right,
but,
right.
you know,
especially in the leaky digital age.
Like, yes.
A couple weeks ago, someone posted 140 photos of the ILM model shop from Jedi.
Those photos are so beautiful.
I know.
And look at getting to see Lauren Peterson and Mike Fulmer's signatures on the Millennium Falcon was so awesome.
I don't know if those are from the archives or if it was someone working there. I mean, they look like professional photos.
Those were taken by the ILM stills department. I am confident. Oh, I'm confident because you get to see the model shop Reach. Have I talked about the model shop Reach?
No.
This is great. This is something we should link to this archive.
Yes.
Take a look at if there's a photo of a model from Star Wars or any other movie, but ILM is expert at this. And there's a model maker in the shot. I guarantee you he's holding an X-Acto blade and he's doing something that you can't quite see on a model that's effectively painted and done.
Okay.
There is nothing that if you need to take an X-Acto knife to a completed model, something has gone wrong. Nobody does that. That is called the model shop reach. The stills department comes in and says, hey, Adam, can you pose with the model? And you grab the nearest tool. So in some of the Cinefex or archive photos of ILM model shop, you can see there's one shot. I think it's Mike Fulmer. Sorry, I'm yelling.
No, it's fine.
You can see, I think it's Mike Fulmer. You can see him holding a blowtorch and a rivet gun. He's working on them, but no one ever looks at what's in their hands.
Oh, that's great. I don't know. Yeah, it's just look someone, busy.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
You're a craftsman.
Jesus is coming. Look busy.
That's
so
amazing.
Look for the model shop Reach. I'm sure there's at least 3 or 4 photos that's in that great. Archive that show it.
Well, I think that'll do it for us today.
Wow.
We have lots of questions left. So we're going to do another episode
next week.
Next week.
Excellent. Or in our reality, 10 minutes from now.
Yeah, 5 minutes from now. If you like the podcast, Always reviews, feedback on iTunes. The best thing you can do to help the podcast is to subscribe on iTunes.
Yes.
And leave positive feedback there. Likes on YouTube are always good. Comments, positive, negative, are welcome. We have new podcasts on the site. Go to tested.com/podcast and you can see the list of them all. There's
how did you come up with that web address?
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's totally shocking.
You know, it used to be where you could buy drug testing kits or maybe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We'll be back next week. Thanks for watching, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.
Hello, Still Untitled listeners. I have a brief request for you guys. We are still collecting survey data from you, the listeners of Still Untitled, The Adam Savage Project. If you have 5 minutes and would love to help the podcast, would really help us a ton if you will go to podsurvey.com/untitled and fill out, again, it's a short, less than 5 minute survey. It helps us connect advertisers that want to advertise to you with you guys. So we'll have ads on the podcast that make sense, you know, given who you are and what you're into. Again, it's just 5 minutes. It's podsurvey.com/untitled. And if you give them your email address, you'll be entered into a recurring drawing to win a $100 Amazon gift certificate, which you could use to buy things like the complete run of Pee-wee's Playhouse. It's out on Blu-ray. It's restored from film. It looks really, really good. And it costs almost exactly $100. Thanks for listening and supporting Still Untitled. We'll see you guys next week. Bye.